In 1996, a young woman was brutally raped and murdered in Idaho Falls. Her killer would serve more than 2 decades in prison. However, was the right man locked up, or was her murderer still walking the streets? In a case in which the victim's own mother would embark on a tireless pursuit for justice, uncovering lies and police coercion, the latest DNA profiling techniques would finally solve a crime and right a serious wrong. This is the murder of Angie Dodge. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Today's case is going to be one that makes you question ethics, authority, and everything in between. It is a shocking case that I'm going to talk about. And I think that for the most part, what we tend to do in our lives is we trust authority. And even when we are shown that it's imperfect, we still tend to have this belief that the authorities are there to protect us, and certainly law enforcers are there to bring the right people to justice. But when it falls short, it's really challenging. Because suddenly you imagine, well, maybe it could happen to me. On the 13th of June 1996, 18-year-old Angie Dodge didn't show up for work at a cosmetics supply shop, which was very unusual for her. That wasn't in keeping with her behaviour. Angie was the youngest of 4 children. She was known to be a really happy, bubbly, outgoing girl. She was very likeable. She was very popular. She had a large group of friends, and she was somebody that was known in her community in a friendly way for all the right reasons. She'd recently graduated high school, so her life was literally just beginning. And what she planned on doing was to go to Idaho State University. She was a bright girl as well, so she was somebody who could have thrived in academia. Also known to be very popular with children, she was one of those people who took time with younger children and would make space for them. So all round, personality-wise, she was somebody that society would benefit from without a doubt. So on this particular day where she doesn't turn up for work, which is completely outside the realms of normal habit for her, 2 co-workers decide that they want to check her upstairs apartment in Idaho Falls because they want to make sure that she is okay. It's awful what they discover. And some of us will experience and encounter those moments in our life where we're worried about somebody, you know, we'll have that sense that something isn't quite right, that somebody's behaviour, such as turning up to work when it doesn't occur, is out of character to the point where it makes us suspicious that something could be wrong. But often you'll put that down to the potential of them being unwell. Maybe they've hurt themselves. Maybe they're just sick in bed. Maybe they drank too much the night before and just didn't get up. These are all things that you suspect. But the idea that you are going to go and check on somebody that you like, a colleague, a friend, and you're gonna discover something truly horrifying is not in the realms of what we consider. But that's exactly what happens. They find Angie's body and they can see immediately she's met a horrific death. She'd actually been raped and she'd been stabbed to death. There were multiple stab wounds on her body, but probably the most severe was that her throat had been severely cut to the point where she'd almost been decapitated. So you can imagine how grotesque that would be for people walking into that scene of carnage to take in the reality of what they're seeing. Now, she bled to death because of this frenzied attack. And genuinely, the scene was a bloodbath. So a detective that was working the case, they were actually cautioned before going into the apartment because it was such a violent crime scene. They were informed it was so graphic that it was going to be traumatizing. And he said, on reflection within his career, it was without doubt the worst that he'd ever seen. And this is for seasoned detectives that meeting that moment, seeing Angie's body in that way, was something that stained his memory. Angie was lying dead on the bedroom floor. She was on her back next to her mattress. Her shirt was torn. It had been pulled up and her sweatpants had been pulled down. Also, there was a very obvious cut to her breast that was visible. So automatically, it gives us insight to the kind of criminal. There's a rageful level, particularly when you start to attack the sexual areas of the individual that you're harming. And also, it suggests a dehumanisation level to the crime. There were multiple stab wounds. She had incisions all around her neck and the carotid artery had been severed. So that's why she bled out so seriously. There were multiple stab wounds all over her body and the blood through this were all over the floor and walls. So deeply savage death. Now, even more tragically, Angie had actually only left home 3 weeks earlier. So like a lot of teenagers, you want to live your way. Your parents want you to live another way. And for the most part, if I look back at when I was 18, and I'm sure a lot of you will relate to this, you kind of think you know everything. You're like, I'm so grown up. But really, you have zero life experience and you don't really understand what it's like to be a grown up whatsoever. But you have points of view, often not substantiated by actual evidence, but you stick to them and it causes conflict. So Angie had had this disagreement with her mother and her mum Carol had said, no, that she had to live in her house under her rules. But this had prompted her to move. Now, imagine being Carol. You lose the daughter that you absolutely adore in an utterly brutal manner. It's an unimaginable scenario to even conceive in your mind. But to have the added ingredient of knowing that had it not been for that disagreement, she would have been safely living at home, that must have been even tougher to manage. Carol did say down the line that there was one thing that she was really grateful for. Obviously, nothing to do with the actual crime itself, but that she was grateful for the fact that she and Angie had actually made up the evening before she died. So Angie had called around, the two of them have hugged, they'd talked it out, and they'd reconciled, which is so important in this case. Because when you suffer a traumatic loss, it's complex territory, grief-wise anyway. But psychologically, when you lose somebody traumatically and there are things that you didn't get to say, or there's been negativity between you before and then the person dies and you can't create closure or create resolution in those scenarios, it can make the already incredibly difficult grief landscape even more troubling. Now, what's really sad is in spite of them making up that evening, Angie did go back to her apartment. So the sliding doors moment happens there. On the day that Angie was killed, her mother actually tried to contact her at work. She wanted to tell her about a family reunion. There was a lunch that had been planned for the next day because her eldest brother was in town. And bear in mind, Angie and her mum have made up. So clearly her mother wants to let her know about anything that's going on in the family to make her feel fully connected to them. However, the co-worker who she's speaking to actually transfers Carol to the human resources manager, who then asks who Carol is. So she says, well, I'm Angie's mother. The manager replied in that moment, Angie's been found dead. You need to go to the police department. I cannot quite compute why the human resources manager would feel it was appropriate for them to break such blindsiding, life-changing, horrific news to Angie's mother, but that's exactly what happened. So she's told by the human resources manager, you need to go to the police department. And Angie's mum has absolutely no understanding in that moment of what's playing out. She doesn't believe it. She just goes into complete shock. So she actually hangs up that phone, stunned, in this surreal climate that she isn't actually sure is happening. And she actually goes and runs a cold shower over her head because she thinks it's a bad dream. She's just waiting to be woken up from this nightmare. It's Angie's brother who goes and identifies her mutilated body. It's the only way to describe it. That poor boy, young man, having to say goodbye to his sister in this way. The inhumanity of it. And carrying those images with him for the rest of his life without doubt. He then tells his mum, who, as we know, is trying to wrap her head around how this has gone from being a day where she's trying to organise a family gathering to starting to organise her daughter's funeral. And he says, "She's gone, Mum." Carol apparently slid down the wall instantly and she curled up and she was totally inconsolable. She just cried uncontrollably. I mean, to hear that your child is dead is the most harrowing experience that any parent could even imagine to endure. But to be told that your child has been murdered, sexually violated, it's beyond comprehension. One of the things that was noted about the scene right from the get-go was that the killer hadn't been forensically cautious, so they had semen, they had hair, including a pubic hair, and they also had other DNA samples that were all collected from the scene, which is clearly going to be music to an investigator's ear. It's as simple as that. You want to have that kind of information available to you. They even found skin beneath Angie's fingernails, so she'd evidently fought. She'd scratched her attacker. When they did the DNA analysis, it all indicated that they belonged to the same man. So essentially in that moment, you conceive that this is a one-person crime. One individual has come in and carried this crime out, hence why there's no other DNA. So there's a murder investigation that's immediately launched. This is an incredibly serious crime. It's completely out of the blue, and it's not typical for the area that these individuals are living. So the police start searching for the killer. They actually go and speak to over 100 men. Each of those 100 men gave a DNA sample. The DNA database also failed to find a match. This is really frustrating. I mean, they're trying to find this person because they know that this kind of a crime is so savage that the individual may potentially strike again, and time is of the essence. Now, months pass, and it's really frustrating for the police. They've got no leads whatsoever. Local community, of course, are fraught. There is real pressure from the local community to find this predator. People didn't feel safe. They wanted justice because Idaho Falls was not a place where people got murdered. So this stuck out like a sore thumb because it was such a grave and savage attack. Now, a break comes in early 1997. So there's a friend of Angie's, Ben Hobbs. He's also from Idaho Falls. He gets arrested on the 5th of January, 1997, and he's arrested for the rape at knife point of a woman in Nevada, which is obviously a horrific crime. So police at this point believe they've got a suspect. Both crimes have been violent sexual assaults. Knife had also been used in both of the crimes. So Hobbs is brought in for questioning. I think that makes perfect sense. You've got somebody who has been charged with a serious rape at knife point, and they were local to the area where another serious rape and murder at knife point had occurred. Kind of makes sense. So Hobbs is soon a murder suspect in the inquiry. And obviously they are desperate to pin this crime down. They want to make sure they get convictions. They want to make sure a predator is off the streets. Now, Hobbs was a member of a group of friends, in fact, and all of those friends had known Angie. She'd spent a lot of time with them. And when they looked at Hobbs's social circle, he was actually part of a larger group, and that larger group was known as the River Rats. I know, it's not the most appealing of titles, is it? I don't think I'd have gone for River Rats. I don't think it sounds charming. It doesn't even sound scary. It just sounds a little bit dirty, personally. Not that I think rats are dirty. They're very lovely. Loyal as dogs, apparently. But anyway, the reason they're called the River Rats, I digress, is because they hung out at various locations along Snake River. Now, this wasn't far from Angie's apartment. So they start to expand the questioning a little bit. The police start speaking to Hobbs' social group. And one of the people that they speak to is 20-year-old Christopher Tapp. So people had actually seen Christopher Tapp with Angie the night before she was murdered. So understandably, that's going to provoke interest from the authorities, because often the last people that are seen with a victim are the people who have ended that victim's life. So on the 7th of January 1997, Tapp gets brought in for questioning. From the get-go, denies any involvement in Angie's murder. Don't get me wrong, I don't think that lots of criminals who are brought in under questioning are like, it was totally me. I'm totally guilty. Obviously, just because somebody doesn't say that they were involved doesn't mean that they weren't involved. But what I'm saying is, really, immediately from that get-go, he says, I've had nothing to do with this situation. Nothing to do with Angie's murder. And he also says that Hobbs, who we know is a suspect, had nothing to do with it as well. So the police collect DNA samples. They also administer a polygraph test. And they, to some degree, should be able to exonerate him, because there's a lot of DNA at the actual crime scene that they've gathered. And a polygraph test, whilst it's not 100% accurate, certainly if somebody passes it, doesn't show that they're under any stress when they're expressing their answers, they're not trying to be deceptive, you can kind of see that it's very unlikely that they're guilty. Now, as it later becomes clear from the tapes of the interview, what was going on during questioning is that the police were completely focused on Hobbs as a suspect. So Tapp, who's been brought in for this questioning, who's obviously denying having anything to do with the murder, he's just the individual that they want information from. He's certainly not in the frame of reference for this crime. It's not under the spotlight at all. So they're trying to get Tapp to implicate Hobbs. And again, at this moment in time, we have some sympathy with the authorities, because Hobbs has been in a scenario where he's raped somebody at knife point. So he fits the MO. But as the questioning goes on, the tapes that are uncovered later down the line regarding how Tapp was interviewed, wow, questionable methods doesn't even begin to describe it. We know interrogators and investigators often manipulate the truth to get confessions. You know, they're allowed to. They're allowed to say things that isn't entirely true, hoping to elicit information from those being questioned. But this is where things really start to go downhill for Tapp. So they start lying to him. They tell him that Hobbs has actually implicated him. Hobbs has apparently placed him at the crime scene. So now Tapp, somebody who's vehemently denied any involvement, is being told that somebody he knows has said that he was at the crime scene. And then the police are saying, well, you know what? If you help us, if you cooperate with us, then we'll be able to go easy on you. Tapp just remained insistent. He said, I'm innocent. I can't help them. And he actually said, I'm just a scared little man. So he's evidencing, even under duress at this moment in time, that he doesn't have a clue what they're talking about. And it doesn't matter what Hobbs is saying. He's not been involved in the rape and murder of this young woman by any stretch of the imagination. Police do not give up on Tapp. So they speak to him on several more occasions, and every single time they speak to him, his story changes. And I mean, it changes big time. And every single time they interview him, it appears that his involvement in Angie's death, which initially he's denied having anything to do with it, actually increases. So we're seeing these transitions. He goes from, I've not had anything to do with this murder, to starting gradually to implicate himself further. He's subjected to around 30 hours of interrogation over several days, which is incredibly stressful. Psychologically, interrogations are meant to be stressful, but when you are consistently interviewed and when people are firing information at you, It is unbelievable how that can affect the psychology. It distorts reality from time to time. And during these interviews, he changes his story 5 times. During the interrogation, the police went to town on him, basically threatened him with the death penalty, which would have been truly terrifying. And if he claimed he couldn't remember something, what would happen was the detectives would suggest it was basically because he'd suppressed that memory. So the horrific nature of the crime had been so traumatizing, even to him as a potential killer, that he'd pushed his memory of that scenario down. Now, on one level, if you think about the fact that he's constantly changing his story, you could say, well, he had something to hide. Why is he desperately trying to make up new facts as he goes? Because that's going to implicate him as he's changing his story because potentially he's guilty. But what we also have to understand is during his interrogation, during the intense pressure that he's under, when he's being threatened with his life, and when the interrogators are not letting up, when they've basically created a story and they want to fit the pieces of the story together, and you're becoming their main player within that story, it's very difficult for an individual to manage the levels of intensity within those scenarios. And often people do start to change their stories, particularly if it gets positive strokes of the people that you're feeling threatened by, because you want your captors, even though these are interrogators, and obviously they are not people who have kidnapped this individual. The point is the psychology remains the same. They are the people who hold your freedom or otherwise. So essentially, when you say things that are met with a positive response from them, often that leads to people saying more things just to get that validation, just to get that feeling that they're doing something right. Another thing that's unbelievable is that during this interrogation that was hideous, really aggressive, his attorney was pretty much present for all of it. So he was watching from a monitor in another room. That's not the kind of attorney that any of us need. Like, literally, an attorney is meant to be on your side. They're meant to protect you. They're meant to understand your rights. They're meant to prevent you getting into scenarios where, I don't know, you just start saying stuff because you're scared of the people who are interviewing you, thus implicating yourself potentially in a crime you may not have been responsible for. Just throwing it out there. So just to give you an example of how things change in his interviews, when he's interviewed for the second time, which is 3 days after his initial, this is the 10th of January, 1997, his version of events are completely different from his first. So now, at this point, he claims, oh yeah, I do know that Hobbs carried out the murder. He told me that he'd killed Angie. And not only that, he's asked me to provide an alibi for him. Now, obviously, the police love that. It's exactly what they were aiming for, because they'd lied to him about Hobbs. Obviously, Hobbs hadn't implicated himself at all, but it had worked. Tap had now implicated Hobbs. So the police then want to speak to Tap again because they want to get more information. And in the interim, his parents actually hired the attorney, and Tap didn't show up to the interview the next day at the agreed time because obviously the lawyer had advised them not to go ahead with that interview without having somebody present. So the officers end up at his mother's house. She tells them that, and she says that her son will attend the interview on the 13th of January. But the officers are like, not happening. So they don't wait. They don't go along with that reasonable request. They just arrest Tap, and they charge him with being an accessory to a felony. They bring him into the station. So this is a major change. You know, we've now got him being charged in this situation. And bear in mind, this is an individual who's thought that by giving information to the police, it would basically get them off his back. Never a sensible thing to do. I think we can all agree that only confess to things that really happened, because genuinely, people want to clear cases up. And if you're willing to accept the rap, the likelihood is they'll throw the book at you. So in his third interview, this is on January the 15th, Tap's changing his story again. So bear in mind, the police had told him that Hobbs had implicated him at the scene of the crime, but Tapp hadn't agreed with that. He'd said, no, I just heard about what had happened. But now he says, oh, actually, I had been at the scene of the crime. And not only had I been there, Hobbs had been really angry with Angie. And he gives a reasoning behind this as to Angie wanting to break up Hobbs's marriage. And then he says that it's when he gets into a rage over this scenario that he watches him stab Angie to death. So Tapp says that he's actually witnessed the murder itself now. On the same day as the third interview, Tapp then begins to enter into a series of immunity agreements with prosecutors. So it's basically a deal, isn't it? If you say this, you'll get this. And often the person who is willing to squeal about criminals who they've been involved in certain scenes of crimes, will get a great deal. Sometimes they'll just walk free. So if you are somebody who's done something really wrong and you're willing to throw your friends under the bus, the reality is that you'll probably get a lighter sentence or you might even get no sentence. But in this case, bear in mind, Tapp has said from the get-go initially that he wasn't even at the scene and that Hobbs had nothing to do with it. And yet now we have him actually making deals with prosecutors. So he's told, if you say all the things that you've said, stroke, we've kind of fed you, we'll only charge you with aiding and abetting an aggravated battery. So this case is certainly being built around Hobbs. The problem they've got, though, is those DNA test results. Because when they get them back, it indicates that neither Hobbs nor Tapp was a match for the DNA at the crime scene, which is major. It's impossible to imagine that only one person's DNA would turn up from that scenario. And if the two individuals that they have under suspicion don't match that DNA, surely it's an open and shut case. They've got the wrong guys. But no, police aren't quite willing to give up on their suspects just yet. Like, well, I mean, all the evidence at the scene clearly suggests that we have the wrong people. But do we have the wrong people? The evidence would say, but do we have the wrong people though? But the evidence and the DNA, but do we have the wrong people? I think we have the wrong people. You're saying we don't have the wrong people. You're not thinking outside of the box. The box being that we imagine it is possible for one person to have carried out the crime with two other people watching the crime, yet somehow those people would be responsible for the crime. You can see where this is going right now. So despite this forensic evidence exonerating both suspects, they just continue to build a case around them. So they truly believe that they're involved. And the thing about bias is that most of us have it in our lives, you know, that person you don't like very much when you first meet them. It takes a lot for them to work really hard to gain a more positive reputation in your mind because you make a snap decision. Think about being a police officer. You've come up with this theory and in your head it just makes so much sense, and you've managed to get a guy to actually admit that they were at the scene and they're cutting a deal. It's going to be really hard for you to think, well, this is a false confession. So you just stick with it. You just keep driving down that road. Now, the problem we do have in this situation is, even though the police think they've got two of the guys, well, there's one completely missing. And that's the person whose DNA has been left at the crime scene. So now Tapp has this immunity agreement, and that means he has to cooperate. And boy, did detectives help him to cooperate. So basically, they feed him a name, Jeremy Sargis. So Jeremy Sargis is another member of Hobbs' social circle. And the detectives basically feed him this idea that Sargis had also been involved. Now, you won't be surprised, because we're going down a theme here, aren't we? Guess what happens with Tapp? He's like, oh, I've just remembered. Yeah, Sargis and Hobbs were both there and they raped and killed Angie. So he's actually just feeding them the lines that he's being fed. And what's even more disturbing is during the interviews, Tapp was fed details about the crime scene. So that makes his statements really incriminating. He's now telling them pieces of evidence that only the killer could know. And they know that. This is how desperate they are to make sure they send individuals down for this crime, even if those individuals aren't even related to it. However, no matter how hard the police are trying to make this story stick, more spanners come in thick and fast because they get the DNA sample from Sargis, and guess what? It isn't a match for the DNA at the crime scene. Also, the guy has a solid alibi. So at this point, the prosecutors accuse Tapp of breaking the terms of their immunity agreement. So because he has basically lied as far as they're concerned and tried to implicate Sargis, what do you mean Sargis, the guy who you told me to implicate? Yes, that's Sargis. You shouldn't have implicated him. This actually happened. So they voided the agreement. So on the 29th of January 1997, he loses his immunity. And if it can't get any worse for Tapp, it's at this point when they void the agreement between them that they start homing in on him. Yeah. They're like, maybe Tapp's our guy. And one can only imagine where Tapp would be psychologically in this moment. He's gone from saying he doesn't know anything about this crime to being an individual who is a viewer of the crime to being considered an accessory for the crime to losing a plea agreement that would have made his part in the crime minimal to now being the main focus. The police take him to the crime scene. This is when his attorney isn't present. I know. What a great attorney. Sounds amazing. We should all hire them. And that means no one knows what was said during that time. But you won't be surprised to know that during the next interview, Tapp changes his story yet again. So according to Tapp, on this occasion, he had been at the crime scene, as had Hobbs, but Sargis hadn't been. So he's now removed Sargis from said crime scene. Instead, there was a friend of Hobbs whom Tapp didn't know was there, and this friend was called Mike. And believe me, when they analyse the interview tapes down the line, it's clear that Tapp comes up with the name Mike on the spot. He doesn't have a second name. He's got no details about him. He just invents him. And that makes sense because he's already just got into serious trouble for presenting that somebody was at the scene who's evidently not been at the scene and has been considered a liar because of that and lost an immunity deal. And now we're in a scenario where he's been asked to create another person at the scene. He's clearly not going to be able to locate that person because that's going to cause him even more problems. So Mythical Mike is invented. And Tapp claims at this point that he had had some involvement in the crime. He said he'd held Angie down during the attack, which is a serious implication for himself. On the 30th of January 1997, Tapp then takes another polygraph test. This would be his fifth. He actually ended up taking seven. Is it just me? Genuinely. Is it just me that feels the authorities weren't getting the answers that they wanted? They were like, take a polygraph test. All right, I will. You've passed. Take another polygraph test. All right, I will. It's passed. Take another polygraph test. I've done two before and I think I've passed them. Just take another one. It's passed. That kind of thing. But it seems like they just want to repeat this again and again and again. And during the questioning, detectives actually suggested that there were ways that he could be treated more leniently. So basically, they say after doing all these polygraph tests and doing all this questioning where suddenly he's escalating his involvement in the crime, now they're throwing him this kind of olive branch, so to speak, this possible change in the way that he's going to be treated by saying if he was in fear of his life after he witnessed the murder, it would go easy on him. So basically he was somebody who was acting in this way because he genuinely thought he might be killed otherwise. At this point, Tap was like, oh no, I can't change my story again. I mean, it would be the fifth time. It'd be the fifth time. I mean, no one's going to believe that I'll have changed my story for the fifth time. He changed his story for the fifth time, guys. So now, apparently he hadn't just held Angie down. He had also slashed her breast with the knife, but only after he was being forced because Hobbs had threatened him. There was no forensic evidence, guys. Like, if this is what he's saying, arguably this should be discredited because if he went near her, there would be forensic evidence on her. So now we have this man basically taking responsibility for part of a heinous murder. Now, the lie detector results actually indicated that Tap was being deceptive about his involvement in Angie's murder. So he'd been asked questions as to what he'd done, and basically he'd taken responsibility for it, and it said he was being deceptive. Arguably, he was telling the truth about not being involved. But that's not the answer that they want to hear. So the investigators tell Tap that he passed, which reinforces this belief and fantasy that's being created in his head. I don't think at this moment in time this guy knows what truth and reality versus fantasy is. He's so gaslit. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about psychological gaslighting of a momentous level. He's believing the lies. He's scared. Now, the police, I suppose, could have looked at the results in one of two ways. So Tap was being deceptive about his involvement because he'd actually been more involved, or that Tap was being deceptive about his involvement because he hadn't been involved. And we all know that they're going to go for the one where he's basically made it clear during that polygraph that he hadn't done what he said he'd done, but they're now going to make that into an amplification and say, well, it's because actually he did even more. And they stick with this theory. They stick with this theory that Tap was definitely there, likely heavily involved, in spite of the fact that the DNA at the crime scene had been left by an unknown assailant. Cases like this really scare me, guys. Because at the end of the day, it means that I could be implicated in a crime if I wasn't there, if there was no DNA, and I don't know, if I had an alibi. If they want to make it stick, seems like they're very adept at making it stick. Get to the 3rd of February 1997. You won't be surprised to know that Tap is charged with first-degree murder, rape, and use of a deadly weapon. Which is bizarre when you think about the fact that Hobbs, he'd been the detective's main suspect from the start. Bearing in mind, Hobbs had actually been charged with a Nevada rape. He was actually later convicted of that rape. Whereas Tap, he hadn't got any criminal past relating to this kind of charge. And he'd been brought in to essentially fit Hobbs up. But despite this, we have Hobbs not being charged with Angie's death, which, of course, he's always denied he had any involvement in. He may have been responsible for the other, but I believe without a doubt that Hobbs never had anything to do with this. It doesn't mean that he isn't a reprehensible human for the kind of actions that he carried out in other crimes, but certainly where Angie's death is concerned, it wasn't him. Also, the police had the charges against Sargis. They were dropped as well. So we end up with Tap suddenly being the suspect. They've built the case around him. And as I said, there's literally not one piece of DNA evidence that matches. But what the police do have is kind of a confession. I'm saying kind of because that man confessed in many different ways to get to the point where they had the one that they were happy with. It took 5 drafts. And even then, when he did admit to some kind of part in the crime, he said that he'd only injured Angie under duress, so he'd never confessed to actually murdering her. And when he was tested on that under the polygraph, did you injure Angie under duress? He came across as being deceptive, meaning no, because he didn't injure her under duress at all. I mean, this is insane. I'm covering this case. I am already at a point where my mind is just lost on how appalling this scenario is and what we are unraveling. We have a guy with no DNA at the scene. We have a guy who didn't have any prior. We have a guy who's passed all the polygraph tests apart from the one, which means that he seems to be innocent of what he's being told to admit to. And this was a guy who was never even considered the suspect initially. Literally, they're still taking him to court. Get the 12th of May, 1998, the trial commences in Idaho. Angie's mother, Carol, who is amazing, incredible. Cannot imagine how she has coped, what she has been through. And you will understand this more as the story goes on, but this woman is a warrior. She went there every single day. She listened to all the aspects of what happened to her gorgeous daughter play out, and that must just be insanely difficult to manage. Tapp's attorney attempted to have all of Tapp's statements to the police excluded, which makes sense because it was clear to him that there was coercion, but the judge denied the request. In fact, the jury were told that Tapp had just volunteered the statements implicating himself in the crime. I have no idea which parts of Tapp's interviews the jury actually heard. So I don't know whether they ever heard the pressure that was placed on him, because there was a lot of pressure placed on him, such as, we're going to send you to the gas chamber. That was one of the threats. Also, the fact that they lie to him about Hobbs implicating him at the scene, that they fed him lines regarding names and crime scene details, because this is why he continually changes his version of events. I doubt that they'll have been able to listen to any of those things. They'll have doctored the investigation and interrogation interviews because they want the jury to see things in a certain way. Now, ultimately, rather than finding evidence of reasonable doubt, it seems that the jury instead considered Tapp's inconsistencies in his evidence as guilt. So instead of seeing that Tapp is changing his story constantly to fit what the police want, they believe that he's doing it because he is actually guilty, and that these inconsistencies demonstrate him to be a liar, and therefore if he's a liar, he could be a rapist and a murderer, which doesn't make any sense, but that's what juries can be like. They don't believe that police coercion has occurred. And other things that happened at the trial, which further jeopardised Tapp's freedom, is that prosecution witnesses get facts incorrect. I say get facts incorrect. I mean, they bloody lie. Yes, they just lie. They should have had a polygraph test for the prosecution witnesses. That would have been good. Mind you, as I've said, it tends to be that they ignored all the ones that were passed, though maybe they'd have done the same with the prosecution witnesses. So one detective testifies that Tapp knew what Angie was wearing before he was shown the crime scene photos. Now that would be really incriminating, of course it would be. But it wouldn't be till much later that would be proven untrue. Also, the later examination of the polygraph and confession videos clearly shows that Tapp didn't mention anything about the clothing until he'd seen the actual photos. So the detective is out and out lying. Also, the prosecution managed to find, I use the word find because that's literally what they did. They were like, you know what we need in this really circumstantial case? We need some witnesses. I don't think we have any witnesses because I'm not sure that the person was there. I don't know where we'll get them. Well, we'll just find them. How? We'll just threaten people and then there'll be witnesses. We need to lock up this seemingly innocent man from society so that the seemingly guilty witnesses who are willing to come in and lie about these individuals are free to roam the streets. Sounds like a plan. Anyway, they go out and they find a witness called Destiny Osborne. Such an ironic name when what she does impacts hugely on this man's destiny. So she claims that she'd basically been at a party a few days after Angie had been killed, She was high on drugs at the time, allegedly, and she overhears a conversation between Tapp and Hobbs, and she claims to hear Hobbs stating that he had killed Angie and it was due to a drug debt. Apparently she owed him money for crystal meth. And in the conversation, also, she hears the alleged implication of Tapp in the killing. Bear in mind, Angie was not a drug user, so this doesn't make sense anyway. But the reality is that when did this matter? When did truth matter in circumstances like this? And also, are we really meant to believe that Destiny, off her FUD on drugs, can be really coherent and suddenly pick up on these really intense conversations of two individuals nearby with very specific details, such as names? I mean, that does not happen ever, but it does in this case. Now, another thing that actually references that Angie wasn't a drug user is that Tapp, during his police interviews, says that Angie had never been involved in drugs. So that doesn't match up with what Destiny is saying. You won't be surprised to know that Destiny was indeed lying massively. Didn't even know who Hobbs was. Didn't even know who he was. It would take 20 years, right up until 2017, before she finally admitted the truth. Now, according to her, the police had threatened to arrest her. She was somebody involved in drugs, and they said that they'd arrest her on drugs charges. So she just basically agreed to testify against Tapp. In fact, they made her practice her testimony before the trial. I mean, that in itself is just malevolent, isn't it? She had to practice what she was saying in court. And even when she was in court and she was being cross-examined and questioned, she literally struggled to remember what she was supposed to say. The detectives got her through it. They just reassured her that she was telling the truth. And they said, what it is, Destiny, is it's not that you don't have any memory of the event. It's not that you don't know these people. It's not that you literally just making this all up. No, it's not. It's that you're so high on drugs that your memory's been impacted. So you don't know your memory, but fortunately, we know your memory, and this is your memory. Repeat after me. This is your good girl. Good girl. You won't be going down for those drugs charges, will you? Unbelievable. Now, Tapp didn't actually testify at the trial, and that was due to the legal advice that he was given. The defense did call witnesses, and those witnesses provided an alibi for Tapp, at which point we should all be like, well, that makes perfect sense, because this guy clearly couldn't have been at the scene because of the reality of the DNA and all the polygraph stuff and the fact that his story makes no sense. And now he's got an alibi. He's got an alibi. So people actually literally saying he was with me. Yeah. Yeah. It's not going to go ahead, is it? It's going to get thrown out. No, it's not. No. And this defense witness should have been really effective. They basically say, look, I know that Tapp could not have committed this crime because he was out with a woman that he shouldn't have been with the evening the murder occurred, because the next morning he was still with that person when his partner walked in on them and caught them. And that meant that they had this big altercation and confrontation, and it had kind of embedded in the witness's memory because it was so unusual. But the prosecution are clever, and they basically make out that the witness who's telling the story is just mistaken about the date. And that's all you have to do. You just want to blur the boundaries and the lines. It's very easy to make people second guess themselves. Psychological tests have been played out in the past where you can literally say 2 and 2 is 5. And if 30 people in a room say it's 5, the person who's 31st will say, oh, it's 5, because they didn't realize all those stooges in the room were just making them conform. So as human beings, it's quite easy at times to convince us that we're wrong. We get to the 28th of May, 1998. There's a jury of 9 women and 3 men, and they find Tapp guilty of all charges. He'd later state, when the jury verdict came down, it was just sadness, pure sadness. I couldn't believe I was going away. I bet he couldn't. None of us can believe he's going away, can we? So he later gets sentenced to life in prison with a minimum term of 30 years for murder and 10 years for rape. So basically his life, essentially. I still can't get my head around how the jury didn't find the police tactics during the interrogation questionable. You know, this ever-changing confession when the police suspicions had suddenly switched. Initially, Hobbs had been the main man that they were interested in. Then they used Tap to implicate him. Tap wasn't the main suspect. Immunity agreement would have allowed him to plead guilty to a far lesser charge. And suddenly the police switched their focus from Hobbs, who doesn't get charged with anything, to Tap, who's now facing rape and murder charges with no apparent further evidence aside from these questionable lie detector results. Results which essentially police had lied to Tap about. You know, they said he'd passed, but what they actually meant was you were deceptive about doing anything bad in this crime. You clearly didn't see yourself as an individual who had been involved in it. So they even manipulated that. You also won't be surprised that it later transpires that not all of the video evidence had been submitted by the prosecution. Yeah, videos of several polygraph tests that proved police coercion and deceit were actually withheld from the defense team. So the jury never got to see them. I mean, this is unbelievable. The truth is, they managed to doctor this case in such a direction that a jury found this man guilty in spite of there being no evidence against him, aside from these sketchy incremental claims about his involvement in the crime. So I don't know what the footage the jury did see, but they didn't see a lot of the important stuff. And they evidently didn't have any concerns about the police, so they definitely didn't see the deceit and coercion levels of the interrogations and tests. Now you'd imagine at this point for Andrew's family, they've just seen a guy go down for a very long time. He's been convicted. So you would hope that they'd get a level of closure on the face of it. A man who'd been found guilty of Angie's killing has been sent down for a minimum of 30 years. In fact, Angie's mother, Carol, she actually pushed for the death penalty initially. She wanted Tap to suffer like her daughter had. Totally understand that. But they didn't have closure. Something didn't fit right. And what's really sad as well is the way that Angie's death impacted on her family. The obvious, of course, you lose somebody that you adore, you lose somebody that you would give your life for in a heartbeat. That's terrible to experience. But what we see when a child is killed in these kind of circumstances, often families break down. It's really difficult to remain united when you're so lonely and isolated in your grief. Angie's father, Jack, he never recovered from his daughter's death. He became estranged from his family, became a recluse, and he died a sad man. So Angie's killer stole more than just her life. They stole her family's fabric. Carol, on the other hand, well, she's like a Rottweiler in the best of ways because she's not satisfied. She's not satisfied at all. And she starts to question Tap's conviction. She's watched the trial play out and it just grates on her. And she has this big fear, and that fear is that her daughter's killer is still walking the streets. So as Angie's mother starts to gather momentum investigating this case herself, Tap starts to launch his appeals against his conviction, including things like alleged inadequate representation, which we can all agree with. I could have done a better job at 15 helping him from my mum and dad's house on the phone than his actual lawyers did. He also takes issue with the fact that the authorities had voided his immunity agreement and the fact that that had been introduced in court, which had to some degree solidified his guilt. They'd seen him lying, apparently, about bringing Sargis into the crime as another testament to him being this diabolical human being who was highly deceitful. They also allege in this appeal that the fact that Tap's changing his story again and again is down to the fact that he's being fed lines by the detectives. So even though the jury didn't consider that, that should have been brought in. He's changing his story because he wants to do and say what gets him the best response from the detectives. And finally, let's be honest, they appeal because there's no bloody evidence at the scene. And if there's no physical evidence, that should be sufficient alone to pose reasonable doubt. And if you have reasonable doubt, you should not be convicted. When you think about that prosecution's case, it was built on a confession that changed four times and the dubious Destiny Osborne coming in with her, well, strangely, I do recall a conversation between two people telling me all the information about this crime. And I was definitely there. I was there. In 2001, the Idaho Court of Appeal ruled that Tapp's statements during his interrogations were not coerced. Yet it also found Tapp's Miranda rights had been violated during several interviews. Like, yeah, you weren't coerced. But what about all these violations of the Miranda rights, which suggests that they didn't engage appropriately? We're going to ignore those because we really want this guy to be guilty. So anyway, they conclude that these violations had been harmless, just a little bit harmless, just threatening you with the gas chamber. Why would that scare you? Just feeding you lines about the scene of the crime that you wouldn't know unless we told you. Just harmless, just a little bit of hijinks. All that matters is getting the right guy for this case, even if the right guy is very obviously the wrong guy. So the conviction stands. Now, bear in mind, Tapp was basically convicted on the strength of the confessions. It's pretty hard to understand how the violations that they saw were harmless. I mean, the fact there were violations demonstrates that his rights had been violated. And the consequences of that is that he started to change his story. So a judge at the original trial had even stated, just to add insult to injury, I can say without equivocation that had Mr. Tapp not confessed, there would have been no conviction in this case. Yes, that's right. Because literally, there was no evidence whatsoever that could have possibly placed him at this murder scene unless, I don't know, he'd been told to say what he said and admit to it. In 2007, the Idaho Innocence Project takes on Tapp's case. For those of you in the States, I'm sure you know what the Innocence Project is. It's amazing. Basically, they want to right miscarriages of justice and they work pro bono to do that. And it's made a difference to many, many people's lives who were wrongly convicted. So the project was founded in 1992 and their whole emphasis is to get people out of prison who have been wrongfully convicted. Now, bear in mind, at the original crime scene, the hairs had been found on Angie's body. And at the time, DNA profiling was pretty much in its infancy. So they had been able to look at the hairs, but they'd only been assessed visually. But things had progressed loads in the decade since. So the project requested that the DNA be tested because mitochondrial DNA testing is really effective, and mitochondrial DNA testing concluded that the hair DNA was consistent with the semen DNA at the crime scene. So that meant that the hair didn't belong to Tapp. So again, testament to the fact that there is zero physical evidence connecting him to the crime scene. So now we have some momentum. Again, it seems like the wrong guy has gone down for this crime, and with this new evidence DNA-wise, it's lending weight to that. So Tapp's defense team, along with the Innocence Project, they attempt to have more evidence DNA tested. In August 2012, the judge denies the request. Like, what? Could we please just test this DNA because we think that maybe the wrong person is in prison, thus meaning that the right person is wandering our streets, potentially doing all the crimes? And they're like, yeah, we don't want to do that. We don't want to acknowledge your request. And this is what the judge said. While DNA testing may be relevant in identifying one of the assailants, such does not make it more probable that Tapp is innocent. Like, no one's ever confessed to something when they didn't actually do it. I mean, that's never happened. We haven't got research papers on the fact that people come out with false confessions under duress, but let's just ignore all of that. No physical evidence tied to the crime. No physical evidence at all that suggested he participated in the murder. And further DNA testing would have excluded him further. It would also have, more importantly, potentially identified someone who was there. So if Tapp's DNA is proven not to be at the crime scene, but someone else's is, how can that not make it more probable that Tapp's innocent? So the judge's conclusion seems completely contradictory. Now, even though Tapp is in prison for this crime, Angie's case still remained a live investigation. So police were still looking for the DNA contributor at the crime scene, but they had failed to identify any more perpetrators of Angie's rape and murder. And this was highly frustrating for Angie's mum, Carol. She's really frustrated. She wants to know who did this to her child. Also, she's starting to get really concerned that Tapp isn't actually guilty. So she turns detective. She starts thoroughly studying the case reports for the next two decades. She just tirelessly investigates her daughter's death. She refuses to let it lie. And she calls in every day at the police station to check if the investigation was on track. She was not going to let this go. And that says something amazing about Carol, doesn't it? She is going to make sure that whoever did this to her child is going to be brought to justice. Carol also got to view the videotapes of Tapp's interrogations. She watched all 30 hours of it, and at this point, she really starts to be concerned. She finds discrepancies in his answers. She starts to suspect that he didn't even know what happened that night. So Carol contacts Tapp's attorney. This is a guy called John Thomas. He's the guy working on the appeals, and she says, "I think Tapp's innocent." And they join forces. So they send Tapp's interrogation videos to an expert in false confessions, a guy called Stephen Drizin. He's the co-director of the Center of Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern University Pritzker School of Law. So really schooled and educated individual in this area. And he worked on a pro bono basis. So he believed that he was dealing with a case of wrongful conviction. And the conclusions that he came out with were powerful. He said that Tapp's confession had been psychologically coerced. He said that the lies and the pressure by the detectives had led to him taking responsibility. Drizin watched the interrogations and saw that Tapp had literally been told he would be sent to the gas chamber. And Drizin later stated, "It's clearly the kind of threat that can lead people to give false confessions." And he also concluded from what he saw that Tapp had been fed information, enough to make his statements credible. Bear in mind, there was no other evidence tying Tapp to the crime scene or the murder. Drizin stated this, "The only certainty that emerges from this police investigation is that the rapist and murderer of Angie Dodge is still on the loose." Later in 2012, they do some partial DNA testing. It's carried out on Angie's shirt and sweatpants and also a teddy bear from the crime scene. The results from those, again, exclude Tapp and Hobbs. Then we get to 2015. At this point, prosecutors offers hire an independent investigator to review Tapp's conviction. And they conclude that a lot of the information that Tapp states during his interrogation was indeed fed to him by law enforcement. Also, the statements the polygrapher made during the tests, as far as they were concerned, were coercive in nature, which is deeply disturbing. But despite this, despite the investigator being like, "Oh, you know what, yeah, turns out a lot of this confession was just like fed to him by the investigators, even like the content, you know, those important details. Yeah, he didn't know them, but we told him. Yeah, investigators told him, yeah." And like, you know, the polygraph test, like there's like coercion in it. All of that is really obvious to me as I'm investigating this. So I'm going to judge that he was still present when Angie was attacked. Yeah, the investigator investigating the investigators agreed that the investigators were right. Don't get me wrong. He did question whether Tapp was personally involved in the killing, but he didn't doubt or dispute that he was there at the scene. Can't imagine what Tat would be like in prison at this moment in time, just the psychological torture of seeing what I believe is corruption playing out. In 2016, Tat's attorney files a motion for post-conviction relief. Now, such motions aim to vacate, set aside, or correct a sentence, or even vacate a conviction altogether. So he claims that Tat's confession had been coerced. Also, he argues that his client's version of events in the confession didn't actually match the evidence. So Tat claims that Angie had been killed around 1 a.m, but Angie had been with her friends at 12:30 a.m. She'd also returned to her apartment and she'd gone to sleep. And when they'd done the autopsy, her bladder was full. So that indicates that she'd been asleep for some time when she was killed. So the crime couldn't have taken place as early as 1 a.m. So these inconsistencies are being brought forward. Get to the 22nd of March 2017. Now, before the motion for post-conviction relief could be heard, a deal is reached. So they offer a deal with the prosecutor. So Tat's rape conviction's vacated and his murder conviction is reduced to time served. Now, bear in mind, he served over 20 years in prison. But nonetheless, at that moment in time, he agrees it because he gets to be free. So Tat's finally released later that year. The fact that he agrees a deal doesn't mean that he's saying he's guilty. It's just that he undoubtedly wants to be free. He's lost 20 years of his freedom. So when he's finally released, he's released knowing that he's accepted that guilt. Now, later that same year, Destiny Osborne goes ahead and tells people that she lied in court. So the only witness that suggested that they had heard or seen anything involving this man in this crime admits that basically she did it under duress. So this solidifies this man's innocence.
I can't tell you how often I hear, oh, I'm a little OCD. I like things neat. That's not OCD. I'm Howie Mandel, and I know this because I have OCD. Actual OCD causes relentless unwanted thoughts. What if I did something terrible and forgot? What if I'm a bad person? Why am I thinking this terrible thing? It makes you question absolutely everything, and you'll do anything to feel better. OCD is debilitating, but it's also highly treatable with the right kind of therapy. Regular talk therapy doesn't cut it. OCD needs specialized therapy. That's why I want to tell you about NoCD. NoCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for OCD. Their licensed therapists provide specialized therapy virtually, and it's covered by insurance for over 155 million Americans. If you think you might be struggling with OCD, visit NoCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call and learn more. That's NoCD.com.
The day he leaves prison, it's unbelievable. He's greeted by Angie's mother. She held his hand. She'd fought for this for years. She wanted him to be free. She knew he was innocent. Tap stated this. Her fighting for me to get out, to get released, and helping me to get something better for me is part of the reason that I'm home today. I'm greatly indebted to that woman. She has no idea. And we have to remember, we're talking about a woman who lost her daughter in the most gruesome and brutal of ways, and she has fought for a man that was sent to prison for that crime. Now, even though Tat's free, he hadn't been exonerated. Now, even though he is no longer considered a sex offender, he was still a convicted murderer in the eyes of the law, and he carries on working to clear his name. Angie, of course, with the police, who she's constantly keeping tabs on, regarding the investigation of her daughter's death, keep searching for the killer. At this point, the Innocence Project joined forces with the Idaho Falls Police. Things have changed. They want to bring people to justice who are guilty of crimes, and DNA profiling has just become so incredible in the years that have passed. So together, they team up with Parabon Nanolabs. That's a company that develops nanopharmaceuticals, and they also provide DNA phenotyping services for law enforcement organizations. So they're basically excellent at placing whose DNA belongs to who. So world-renowned genetic genealogist Cece Moore, they work on Angie's case. The DNA profile from the crime scene gets run through the genetic database, and What they do then is they use genetic genealogy to build the suspect's family tree. So they compare the crime scene DNA evidence to the public genetic databases, and through this, they're able to identify potential suspects through their family members. Now, six people of interest were subsequently identified, but ultimately all six of those were ruled out. However, further analysis of a family tree established this. One of the men in the family had got married early and divorced, and a child had been born shortly after that couple had separated. That child was now 53-year-old Brian L. Drips Sr. He would have been 30 when Angie was killed. He was a father of three, and he'd actually spent the last two decades raising his children from a failed marriage. Drips had been adopted as a child, he'd later joined the military, and then he'd gone on to work in construction. But he was actually using his stepfather's surname, and that's why he hadn't shown up in the original search. Drips' health had actually been in decline for years. He suffered from several chronic conditions, and he actually went on to have a heart attack in custody. But he was the seventh person of interest identified. He was now living on the opposite side of Idaho in a place called Caldwell. But at the time of Angie's murder, he lived directly across her street. He even moved away the same year, which is incriminating in itself. Apparently, he'd only ever known Angie as a passing acquaintance, and Drips had been spoken to originally by the investigators. He was noted as a potential witness, but he hadn't proved any help. He said he'd been out and he drank a lot. Police at this point want some DNA samples from him because they want to know whether they have the right guy. And bear in mind, isn't it ironic that this guy who lived directly across the road from Angie wasn't considered a suspect and seemed to get away with having an alibi of, I don't know, I was just out drinking a lot. And the investigators were like, that's fine. But they wait to get a DNA sample off him. So they watch him for days and then they manage to get a cigarette butt. They do the DNA testing and he's an exact match for the semen and the hair found at the crime scene. Bang to rights. So Drips gets brought in for questioning and he's faced with the DNA evidence and pretty much from the get-go, he confesses to Angie's rape and murder. He just stated, I did it, I raped her and apparently I killed her. He said he'd been high on cocaine and he was drunk, said that Angie was asleep and that his intention was to go into her apartment to rape her. He said he had a pocket knife, but that he didn't intend to murder her. He later claimed in court, it just happened, which is bizarre when you consider the gravity of this crime and the fact that this poor girl was all but decapitated. And he did that with a pocket knife. He didn't deny what he'd inflicted on Angie's body, but he didn't actually recall doing it. That's what he said. But I don't believe that for a minute. The savagery on her would have been so frenzied that it's impossible to imagine it would not have stained his memory. I think it's one of those scenarios where the individual knows exactly what they did, but they don't acknowledge it because then it would demonstrate the kind of animal that they were. On the 15th of May 2019, almost 23 years after Angie was killed, Drip was arrested and charged for her rape and first degree murder. That's 23 years of freedom that that monster had. 23 years of living his life whilst another man was locked up for a crime he didn't commit. Drip also confirmed that he acted alone, so Tap wasn't involved at all. You know, he'd let that man serve 20 years for a crime he didn't commit. He was 20 years old when he was arrested. He was 41 when he was released. He lost the best years of his life. He'd been an inmate number 56265 for over two decades. All the while, the true killer had just been living his life. Finally, on the 17th of July 2019, Christopher Tapp's murder conviction was finally vacated. A judge stated, as far as the court is concerned, you're cleared of the charges you've been living under for the past 20 plus years. Following his release, Tapp stated, so thankful that I've been given this second chance at life. I've wasted 20 years of my life for something I never did. But I also grew up over those 20 years. I mean, my God, the humility of this individual is astounding. I mean, to not just feel pure bitterness for what he had taken, to be able to manifest the positives that he's done growing up, he's learned about himself, obviously forced resilience, and to be able to use it in such a humble way when talking about something that so many of us would just feel absolute anger over is testament to the kind of character he is. And at the hearing where his conviction was overturned, Carol Dodge went over and hugged him. Just demonstrates what a lovely human being she is. In 2019, Tapp claimed damages against the City of Idaho Falls and seven former Idaho Falls Police Department officers. Which you would, wouldn't you? You've taken 20 years of my life. Now, cough up, because I've lost so much. I mean, literally, it's impossible to reimburse someone for those kind of years stolen, but money will, to some degree, allow you to live a different kind of life than you would have without it. And in June 2022, the Idaho Falls City Council voted to accept a settlement agreement with Tapp. He was awarded $11.7 million in damages, which is a fair amount of money, one can say. Again, doesn't make up for those years, but it means that his life and lifestyle will probably be a pretty good one from this day on. And I think it's really important that that money was paid, because that's the only way you can hit authorities and organisations. It's in their purse, so to speak. On the 9th of February 2021, Drips pleaded guilty to Angie's rape and first-degree murder, and he was sentenced to life with a minimum term of 20 years. The reason that he had a shorter sentence was because of the fact that he just went early in his plea. I mean, I don't think that's appropriate. How could him saying 25 years later that he was guilty be an early plea? But there you go. That's actually the way this crazy world works sometimes. And that means that theoretically, by the way, he could serve less time than Tapp. Yeah. Makes sense, doesn't it? Also, likelihood is he'll probably die in prison because he's got quite bad health anyway. The judge stated this: a young man spent a significant part of his life in prison for no reason. He was innocent. That falls on you. I mean, true. Yeah, it definitely does. This horrific human who took the life of this poor girl, it's all on him, the crime. But I think the judge should also feel that it falls a little bit on, I don't know, the massively coercive and deceitful detectives who were dealing with the original investigation a bit. Don't you? Just a little bit. Just like, maybe if they hadn't just lied about all that and created this false narrative and forced somebody to confess, this would never have happened. But who am I to just throw out common sense perspectives like that? You also have to wonder, bearing in mind the fact that the police interviewed and took DNA samples from over 100 men during the original investigation, how they didn't take one from the dodgy-looking guy who was apparently really drunk on the night of the murder and who lived opposite the victim. Maybe I'm missing something, but I don't think I am. Drips did give a brief statement in court. He said, "I just wish I could do over that night. I'm so sorry. I know you'll never forgive me, but I am sorry." With respect, mate, just putting it out there, the fact that you failed to own up to what you did for over 20 years suggests that's a pile of BS. End of. Angie's mum, of course, is one of the real victims here. And her victim impact statement read, at least in part, "You've shattered our family. There is no way to pick up the pieces ever again. You, Brian Drips, deserve eternal hell." And I think we can all take a vote and agree that that is an appropriate victim impact statement that we all respect. And I imagine Drips will have a personal interview at some point to dictate what his eternal suffering will be in hell. When Drips was convicted, Idaho Falls Police Chief Bryce Johnson said basically the case would never have been solved without Carol Dodge. So Angie's mother was the driving force behind it. He stated, Carol, for 23 years, every second of every day, she has been looking out for her daughter. This case begins and ends with Carol. And Carol actually explained what was the driving force for her, what gave her that strength to just carry on fighting all those years. And she said, if I hadn't had the opportunity to hold Angie in my arms that night and to tell her how much I love her, I don't know I could have made it. It's what kept me determined to find out why my daughter was killed. So it was that reunification of her and her daughter, that remedying of that argument that they'd had, that recognition of how loved they were in one another's lives, that was something she'd return to. And it would just enable her to use that image and that memory to spur on the dedication that she's shown this case. Now, I don't know how you guys feel about this case, but for me, it's one of those that the whole way through when researching it, I was shaking my head. How can a man be found guilty with no evidence against him at all? How can the authorities perpetrate lies and fake polygraph tests and threaten people to be witnesses against somebody who arguably hadn't been anywhere near the place that this woman was killed? That says something really powerful. It reminds us that no matter who you are, no matter what you're doing, if there is the right level of corruption around you, and there is an individual who decides that they want to fit a narrative around you, then it's really difficult to walk away in these situations. And a lot of you will probably struggle with the idea of why anybody would falsely confess, but there is so much research on this, and people genuinely do. They're exhausted, they're scared, they're threatened, and in the end, they just say what they need to say to try to make it stop. But the problem is, one of the most powerful pieces of evidence in any case is when somebody confesses to the crime. So it's a real problem when somebody is so psychologically distressed or exhausted that they just agree, because in the long term, that's why the likelihood is they'll be found guilty. Let me know your thoughts. Like I said, this is obviously something that we have to remember is about a young girl, Angie, who lost her life in the most brutal and heinous of manners, but she deserved better than she was given. She deserved the man who did what he did to her to have lost his freedom as a young man and not been able to go on to have three children and be free. And now, with respect, be looked after in prison, his healthcare needs taken care of, fed, and genuinely in a scenario that he denied Angie. She didn't get to live her life. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.